You are specially welcome. Do take a seat if you're just arriving. And welcome to this special event as part of the Canary Wharf's first ever Festival of Thought, this special week of events. And our topic today is, dear to us all, so how to be happy. Before I introduce our speaker for today, we're going to have a special welcome on the screen here from somebody you may recognise. So I'll hand over to him to say welcome to, if this thing works. Oh, hold on, no. This is supposed to... It's given up. Oh, drat. Oh, well. It was the Archbishop of Canterbury who was saying welcome to the festival. Drat. Okay, doesn't matter. Our guest speaker today, we'll move swiftly on from the Archbishop to our guest speaker today, is a native of Austria, so in the lovely mountains. And he's had a pretty varied career, so he's worked in government relations in Washington, D.C., he's worked in Austria as a freelance interpreter and as a lecturer in translation at the University of Innsbruck. He previously completed master's degrees in translation and interpreting at the University of Innsbruck. He studied theology at Oxford University. He earned 3 degrees and several prizes, scholarships, gained the top first class award in 2008. And on it goes. Distinguished guests, would you please welcome the Reverend Dr. Christian Hofreiter.
Thank you very much. It's very kind of you. Am I still on mute? I think I did unmute myself. Thank you. Well, it's wonderful to be here. Very good pronunciation of my name as well. So, chapeau. That's rarely happens. And it's wonderful to be here with you this lunchtime in the context of this Thought Week or Festival of Thought. And that's what I'll invite you to do, to think on a question that at one time or another is a question that we ask ourselves, perhaps mostly when we're young, teenagers or at university, what should I do with my life? What will make me happy? And then somehow things happen, life happens, and it can be a few years before we ask this question again. So I'm very happy that you're here to open up this question and to think about it, how to be happy, what is happiness? And it is a question that has fascinated humans for millennia. There has been debate, there has been discussion, and there have been attempts at achieving a happy life. Obviously, for as long as we can look back in history, in a sense, you could look at each and every single human life as one new attempt, one trial to achieve a happy life. Because very few people set out purposely not to have a happy life. There may be some, but it is probably the exception. So it's a desire that, in a sense, unites us, but also just saying that doesn't say very much because it leaves very much open, very much to be defined. If we were very skeptical, we might say, well, in our day and age, perhaps people think happiness comes primarily through being the best in your job, making the most money. He who or she who dies with the most toys wins. So that would be a cynical look at it, or to say, well, it is whoever has the most exciting sexual encounters wins, because that's the maximization of happiness. And so on. So we could be quite cynical, and I'm sure actually if we look around our culture and we read the newspapers and watch the films that come out of Hollywood and other places, sometimes this is what is presented to us as the happy life. Certainly the advertising industry does their best to think if we only have this watch that we can bequeath to our children, or that boat, or whatever it may be, then we will be happy. And they're very powerful at suggesting these things to us. Now, I think most of us, if we stop to think about it, aren't fooled by that. That doesn't mean that it still drives our life. It might still drive our life. But if we think about it, most of us have the feeling, well, that's probably not really what true happiness is. If you talk a bit longer, that usually people will say, well, as long as you're healthy, that's a great thing. And if everything is all right in your relationships with your family, then that is really what we should aspire to. And I think that's a lot more grounded and realistic. And that certainly, I think we don't have to be as cynical as just saying it's all just superficial pursuits that drives people in our day and age. But even so, that leaves us open too many vulnerabilities. For instance, health is not something we can program, we can guarantee, we can avoid certain risks, certainly, but it is something that can very easily be taken from us, and the same is true in relationships and families. So in a sense, even that pursuit of happiness comes with risks that we cannot control. And so this question of the risks that we cannot control and how we should go about facing these risks is something that the ancient philosophers of Greece discussed. Aristotle, the Stoics, the Epicureans, they all agreed happiness was a good thing. Actually, Aristotle in his Ethics begins with a discussion of what eudaimonia is like, the good life, what living well means. Because, he says, that is, we can all agree, the goal of human life. That is what we want to do, but obviously it needs definition. And so they debated, should you get involved in politics? And by and large, the Stoics and the Aristotelians said, well, yes, you know, you should work for the common good, you should engage in the polis. Whereas the Epicureans said, no, you know, this only disturbs your peace. You should withdraw, you should have your own private garden where you can retreat to, and don't get involved in politics because it is only trouble. And I think probably the experience of many politicians bears that latter view out, whatever the merits of the challenges they face may be. Or they said, well, what about desire? Now, we would think today, when we think of people pursuing happiness, oftentimes it's a pursuit of desire, a pursuit of intense feelings. But there were great divisions among the ancients whether that is actually a good thing or not. The Epicureans, obviously known today, even though what we call Epicureans today is not quite what Epicurus stood for, but they said, yes, pleasure is very important. Whereas Aristotle said, well, pleasure plays a role in motivation. It's something we look after, but it's also deceptive. It's also dangerous. And the Stoics said, no, running after pleasure will only lead you astray. This is very dangerous. Stay away from it. Be stoic about it. And so you see that there are very different views on very core decisions, what you should pursue, and people were not of one mind. Now, what in the olden days were the philosophers who were thinking about what the good life is, in our day and age, I think, are the psychologists oftentimes. I don't come from Vienna, but I live in Vienna now. And that's the place where Sigmund Freud developed his very influential ideas. Of course, I'll come back to Freud because he had some very interesting things to say about happiness and religion. But more recently, maybe in the last 20 years or so, there has been a phenomenon that many of you might be aware of called positive psychology. And basically, it is the attempt for psychology not to focus on sorting out what's wrong, not to focus on depression, and to focus on all the malaises that people might suffer from, but to actually say, we should also, as psychologists, think about how people can live happy lives. And there are a number of names associated with that. Perhaps the most well-known one is Martin Seligman, who wrote a book called Authentic Happiness in 2002, and then updated his theory and said, well, actually, I think my first theory wasn't quite spot on, and it needs a major rework only 9 years later, in 2011, and he now calls it well-being theory, which I think is actually a good thing if, as an academic, you say, well, my theory wasn't quite good, you know, let's renew it, rather than sticking to your guns, whether you think it was borne out or not. And he has sort of five criteria for human flourishing that can be summarized under PERMA. Positive relationships, positive emotion, engagement, meaning, and accomplishment. Those are areas, he says, if you have these five areas, then you're flourishing, then you're doing well. Of course, each of these words needs to be further defined, but I found it's interesting. There is again this attempt, much like the Stoics over 2 millennia ago and the other philosophers, there are people today who say, how can we define it? How can we put our finger on what the good life is? And then how can we tell people how to achieve it? So very fascinating. Another person, George Valent, I found really fascinating, psychologist as well, and he joined a study that was begun in 1938. He joined that study in 1966 as one of the curators and then the leader of the study. And the study is still ongoing. So it's a study in 1938. It was begun at Harvard University. And they picked 250 undergraduates. They were all men, so perhaps that skews the results a little bit. But and there are some comparative studies that are all female that sometimes I use to correlate the two. It's called the Grant Study. Some of you might have come across it. So it's a longitudinal study, and it is still ongoing because not all of them have died yet. Most of them have, obviously. From 1938, there were around 20 then. And what it does, it gives you a very interesting record of people's life because they had in-depth interviews every few years, personal interviews, then they had long questionnaires, they had health tests, and they had it over years and years and years and decades. And it's absolutely fascinating when you read what looks to be very promising. Some stories, there's one particular person I have in mind, and it seemed like this person had everything going for him. He was going to make it. He was going to be the most successful. And basically, his life fell to pieces very, very quickly after university. And there were others who maybe didn't seem to stand out as much in university life, and they ended up doing very well. But of course, it begs the question very well, by whose standards? You know, how do you measure success? And so George Bailand wanted to find out what predicts well-being in old age. So in order to have predictor variables, you need outcome variables. So he came up with a decathlon of human flourishing that includes two for occupational success, two for mental health in old age, two for physical health in old age, and four for good relationship in old age. Sort of success in your job, for instance, he measured by whether you made it into the who's who or not. So those are the, you know, and actually, and then he found out, well, that actually favors some professions over others because some are less likely to make it into something like the who's who. So, but again, I'm mostly fascinated. Here's a man who says, how can we quantify what the good life is? So we can then, as an academic, predict how you find the good life. So he has this decathlon of human flourishing. It's in the 2012 book, Triumphs of Experience, that he wrote. At that point, being 78 himself. And he wrote already when he was a young man in his 40s about the people who were a few decades his seniors. And in his later books, he says, I had no idea. I was writing about what it means to grow old, but I was a young man, so I didn't know what I was doing. That's absolutely fascinating person. There's a long article about him, and also his life, his personal life, actually does not seem to have been that happy, which is also quite fascinating. So that's George Bailand. If you're interested in the predictor variables, the one that he found to be the most suited to predict well-being in old life is actually, it's not social class at all. That's absolutely not significant. Very few physical characters that can predict anything. Because in the 30s, even in America, people thought it's probably down to your physical state. You know, obviously people in Austria took that to other extremes. But what he found the most important predictor is attachment, whether you have a warm upbringing or not. So that's an interesting thing right there. And as I was researching what people were saying today, as they were debating what constitutes a happy life, how do you find a happy life, I came across a meta-study drawing on many, many various individual studies and trying to see whether religion leads to a happier life. And I was fascinated by it. So but the bottom line seems to be that religious people report being happier and more satisfied with their lives than non-religious people. So from all these studies, dozens of studies that they took together in a meta-study, that was one of the outcomes. There might be differences between various religions and religious subgroups, but that seems to have been the bottom line. But then they say, I think very perceptively, these two researchers, they say, does religion contribute to human well-being? The psychological approach to answering this question presupposes that social scientists can accurately define well-being. However, measurements of individual happiness, life satisfaction, subjective well-being may actually reflect the scientists' own values, cultural inputs, and religious views. So the point is, well, yes, it might look to you as a researcher that this contributes to a happier life, but perhaps you've already set it up in such a way that you only find out what you already believe. So, but let's say, by and large, what this meta-study says, if you're religious, you'll be, by and large, happier than if not. Should you therefore become religious? And a friend of mine phrases it like this, and you might have come across this as well, and I certainly have friends who tell me, you know, I'm really excited that you believe. You know, this seems to be so good for you. You're clearly, you draw great strength from your faith. It seems to make you very happy. And actually, you know, I would love to be able to believe. I would love to be able to believe like you, but I just can't. Which sounds like a really good compliment. Until you think about it and think, so what do we call people who believe in something that doesn't exist? Well, we call them deluded or insane. So essentially what my friends are telling me, Christian, you know what? You are insane. You are deluded. But your delusion and insanity makes you very happy. And if only I could bring myself to be deluded and to be insane, I would gladly become deluded and insane. But I'm just a rational human being, and I can't. So you see, you know, sometimes those compliments aren't perhaps as persuasive as they appear at first sight. So should you believe it? And I said I'll come back to Sigmund Freud. What Sigmund Freud popularized was a theory that a German philosopher called Ludwig Feuerbach and then also Karl Marx were also working on, namely the idea that religion, yes, it produces some form of happiness, but it's the opium of the people. It is something that basically leads you to a delusion. You project what you want onto some celestial father figure, but it is all just a delusion. It's a psychological crutch. If you were serious and an adult, you would do away with it. And many people have found that persuasive. Many people would say, well, you know, that's probably what it is. But if you take a step back and think about it, does it actually prove anything at all? Well, this argument, Freud's argument, Marx's argument, for it to work, it assumes already the conclusion. So the conclusion is there is no God. But for this to work, you all already have to begin with there is no God, therefore religious feeling, belief is only a projection, therefore there is no God. So it's completely circular. Because if there is a God, it would also stand to reason if we were made by this God and for a relationship with this God that we would be happy by it. So it actually proves nothing at all. It just says, well, if there is no God, then perhaps we can explain the widespread belief that there is a God and the fact that it makes people happy by some sort of projection theory. But it has said nothing about whether there might be a God or there may not be a God, or even whether it's likely or not that there is a God. So you see, it's sort of a short-circuiting of logic, and sometimes it seems very persuasive, much like the compliment that I mentioned earlier. And as I was researching this further, I was fascinated to find a long tradition of brilliant thinkers who have looked at the same phenomenon that Sigmund Freud observed and have come to exactly the opposite conclusion. And the person who, in my view, perhaps put it most succinctly is the Oxford Don of the 20th century and literature professor and also a writer, author, C.S. Lewis, who, as many of you might know, came as an atheist to Oxford and then over a period of 10 years went from atheism to deism to theism and ultimately became a Christian. And he expressed it like this. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. So if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. And he's not the only one. He stands in a long, long tradition. There's Blaise Pascal, the French mathematician and philosopher, who put it like this. He says, in human beings, there is a bottomless abyss that can only be filled with an infinite and unchanging object, that is to say, by God himself. So essentially, sometimes that is rephrased as a God-shaped vacuum. So Pascal's observation was there is something in the human heart that nothing can fill, a desire, a longing, a bottomless pit that only an infinite object, God himself, can fill. very similar observation. And about more than a millennium before Pascal, a young man who had sought happiness in many ways, had led a life of many pursuits, sexual pursuits, philosophical pursuits, political pursuits, and had been left wanting, and eventually came face to face with the Christian faith and was deeply moved by it and converted. We know him today as Saint Augustine. He wasn't always the same, if you read his confessions. And at the beginning of the confessions, he puts it like this. He says, addressing God, "You have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until we find our rest in you." So again, this restlessness, this searching in the human heart, for Augustine was a very, very clear indication that we are made for something beyond this world, for something bigger than this world. Now, that doesn't mean, obviously, that this, things like family and health and work and all these other things aren't good things and valuable things and can contribute to our happiness. But if they become replacements for the ultimate, then C.S. Lewis puts it very well. I'll read this because he's so poetic. This is from a text he first delivered in Oxford in 1942 called The Weight of Glory. And the language he uses is the language of desire. He says there is this desire in the human heart. And again, he sees it as being indicative of something very deep and very true. Then he says, "In speaking of this desire of our own far-off country, which we find in ourselves even now, I feel a certain shyness. I'm almost committing an indecency. I'm trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each one of you. The secret which hurts so much that you take your revenge on it by calling it names like nostalgia and romanticism and adolescence. The secret also which pierces with such sweetness that when in very intimate conversation the mention of it becomes imminent, we grow awkward and affect to laugh at ourselves. The secret we cannot hide and cannot tell, though we desire to do both. We cannot tell it because it is a desire for something which has never actually appeared in our experience. We cannot hide it because our experience is constantly suggesting it, and we betray ourselves like lovers at the mention of our name. Our commonest expedient is to call it beauty and to behave as if that settled the matter. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But, and this is, I think, very insightful, if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshippers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. Do what they will, then, we remain conscious of a desire which no natural happiness will satisfy." I don't know how you relate to that, whether that makes you think of maybe standing in nature and looking at the sky with the stars, sort of the nightly sky filled with stars, or you think of experiences of beauty in terms of listening to music that just grabs you so deeply and makes you alive and pulls strings in your hearts that touch something that is very deep, very intimate, and it's very hard to put in words. But you know there is something that the philosophers call transcendence. It points, in a sense, beyond itself. And that's what these people, Lewis, Pascal, and Augustine, say. This is really appointed that we were made for God, and that in God and in our relationship with God, we can find this happiness. An American philosopher called Kreeft, has actually turned this into a formal argument for the existence of God. I'll just give that to you quickly. He says, first, every natural innate desire in us corresponds to some real object that can satisfy that desire. So every natural desire has an object that can satisfy it. So we feel hunger, there's such a thing as food. We feel thirst, there's such a thing as drink. And to all those natural desires, there's something that can satisfy it. Two, but there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, no creature can satisfy. Three, therefore there must exist something more than time, earth, and creatures which can satisfy this desire. This something is what people call God and life with God forever. So you can see, you can turn this actually completely upside down, what Freud tried to do, and say, actually, it is much more likely that this points to something true, to something real, that there is a God and that we can know him, and we are not completely satisfied because we were made for something greater than just success in this world. And many of you will have experienced that, probably reaching some goal, and at the end of it, it wasn't quite as good as you thought it might be. And what stands before me especially is a friend of mine who was a professional baseball player in America before he came to study in Oxford, and he had pitched for a number of teams, including the New York Yankees, and he had won the World Series with them. Now, World Series in baseball, you know, that's just two countries, right? But anyways, it's the World Series. It's the biggest thing in baseball. So they had won the World Series, and it doesn't get any better than that. And he was the pitcher. And as they were out there celebrating in a stretch limo, driving around New York City, they had been playing at home, Yankee Stadium, they drove across the Hudson, and my friend Dan told the driver, said, "Pull over. I want to jump." And they thought he was joking around, but he was not joking. He did not jump. But he was so disappointed. He was so deflated that this was it. And my friend Jason here, who's played 17 years in the NFL, very similar story when they won the Super Bowl and were flying home on their corporate jet, two rookies, he overheard them saying, "Is that it? Is that it?" And so oftentimes we come to the top and we think, is that it? Was that it? And again, I think it stands to reason to say that this points to something beyond our experience in this world, that we are made, as Lewis says, for another world. And speaking as a Christian, I find that the Christian story ties in with that desire at an incredibly deep and powerful level. Jesus, obviously quite important in Christianity, he said the following, "Come to me, all you that are weary and are carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And I think especially if we feel we're caught in the rat race, the corporate rat race, the rat race of competition, even among siblings, in families, and whatever rat race we're in, even perhaps the rat race to try and please God, because that too can become a rat race. That too can become this burden to try and do right by a God whom we've never really experienced, that we are not quite sure that we even know. And I find these words of Jesus just speaking so deeply into the human heart and ringing so true and speaking to a desire that is so deep. And the wonderful thing, in my view, of the Christian message is that we don't believe in a God who is the end of a logical argument. Though there are logical arguments for the existence of God, I personally believe that the fine-tuning of the universe that many physicists have observed is a very powerful argument that the universe was designed. I believe there's a very strong argument to be made from our moral intuitions and our sense, our deep intuition, that there is something that is good and evil, irrespective of human definition. So I believe there are very, very strong, powerful philosophical arguments. I believe there are very strong arguments that actually Christ rose from the dead historically. And I think there will be a talk given by a friend of mine, a lawyer, examining the evidence for the resurrection. I think you're talking on this, Simon, is this right? Yes. So I think there is evidence, but I think there's something beyond just God being at the end of a very well-informed guess or even a logical deduction. But God comes into our experience. That's the staggering claim that Christians make, is that the God who created the universe with 10 to the power of 11 galaxies, so it's 100 billion galaxies Even if you work in a bank, 100 billion is a lot. But in each of these 100 billion galaxies, there are 100 billion stars. So the number of stars in the universe alone is 10 to the power of 22. That's a 1 with 22 zeros afterwards. So if there is a God, this God is incredibly, immeasurably large and big and should be incomprehensible to us because we are just on a speck of dust somewhere in this vast universe, 14 billion light years across. But what Christians believe is that this God was so interested in us, took such a personal interest that he became human. And that in Jesus, when we look at the face of Jesus, we see the face of the Creator. We see the face of the one who flung into existence 100 billion galaxies with 100 billion stars in them and who sustains them. The God who can, who knows, as the Bible says at one point, every hair on our head, who is intimately involved with every detail in our life. And so, as part of this festival of thought, I just want to encourage you, if you feel this longing in yourself, if you feel this longing for something beyond what the rat race or other pursuits that in and of themselves are not bad pursuits, but actually are good pursuits from a Christian perspective, but that they cannot satisfy, I encourage you to keep exploring it. I encourage you to keep seeking it. And there might be some here, and you might say, actually, you know what? I know this is true. This rings true. I know in my heart this is true. Then I would like to invite you to just say yes. The Archbishop actually really did some videos for us. They're online, so we didn't just make this up. I spoke on integrity yesterday, so we have that much integrity. And they're online, and he explains in one of the videos that are on the website, he explains very simply what the message of Christianity is and how we can begin this life of faith. And essentially what he says, and I think is a very good way of putting it, is we just say, sorry, thank you, please. That should please the English, that good manners, you know, even can, you know, be very helpful in your relationship with God. So basically we say sorry to God for living a life without you, doing things that we ought not to have done, and not doing things that we ought to have done. Basically what the Bible says, missing the mark. So we say sorry. And then we say, thank you that you love me nonetheless. Thank you that you did become human, that you came to us, that you love us so much, that you came to us. And not only did God come, but the Son of God took our place. He identified both with us as victims of suffering when he was there suffering, dying on the cross, but also with us as perpetrators, as those who cause suffering to others and who miss the mark with respect to God. So he identifies, God himself identifies with our victimhood and with us as perpetrators. And so we say thank you for that. And then we say, please help me to live with you to experience more and more of this happiness that comes from knowing who you are. And so some of you might say, listen, this was 10 steps too fast for me. You had one or two interesting points, and I'm happy to discuss them with you afterwards. And I'm very glad that you were here, and I'm very happy to discuss it with you afterwards. And please feel no pressure to go anywhere further than where the conviction of your heart and your mind would take you. Others might say, I'm really interested in this, but I do have big questions that I need to explore before I make this decision. Again, please don't let anyone force you into anything or pressure you into anything. This is, in my view, the most important decision that you'll ever make in your life. But I think there may be some here, and this has been a journey for you, and you say, actually, yes, I want to do this. So if it's okay, if you have questions or a reservation, please think of them and think of what you would like to say in response or ask. But bear with me as I just invite those who would like to do that to pray a prayer, simple prayer of commitment along these three steps. Just pray it along in your heart if that's you. Dear God, I'm sorry for not always being the person that I could be and that I want to be. I'm sorry for living without you. Please forgive me. Thank you that you love me. Thank you that you came to me in Jesus. Please help me to follow you and to find wholeness and happiness in your love. Amen. Thank you so much for bearing with me. Again, wherever you are on your journey, I hope that you felt you had the space to think and to be yourself and to engage with this very freely. I'd like to invite you. There are some feedback cards. We really, whatever your feedback is, even if you say, you know, I didn't like this, I didn't like any of it, that's fine. I do want to know. We do want to know. If you leave us your name and a way to contact you, we would love to continue the conversation. It says down there, carrying on the conversation. And there are two boxes in the middle. One says, tell me more. One says, count me in. The tell me more is if you say, I'm interested, but I'm not quite there, you know, sort of to jump in with both feet. But tell me more if there's a way to explore this further, these kind of conversations, then we'll be in touch with you. There'll be something beginning here soon. Marcus will tell you about that in a moment. But if you are perhaps in that place and today you've said, you know what, this rings true to me. I want to begin this life with Jesus. Then please just say, count me in. You know, I want to go. I want to give this a go. I want to follow Jesus. It's been a great pleasure to be with you here in Canary Wharf. And thank you again for your patience and your forbearance with me. And I'm very happy to chat with you for as long as you have time. But, you know, so you don't lose your job, you know, I hope. Okay. Thank you very much.
Just reminds me to say there is a bookstall on the table over there, so please do have a browse and help yourself if you'd like to. In terms of finding out more, we've got an event tomorrow lunchtime, which instead of having a speaker just speaking at you, it's over.